And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we begin, though, I want to let you know about a unique ebook that's yours to download free today. It's called Googling God, and in it you'll find truth-filled answers to the top five questions people ask online about God. Googling God outlines core apologetic responses to life's deepest questions, helping you know why you believe what you believe. More importantly, it will prepare you to respond with confidence and grace to questions and objections that come your way as you live and speak for Christ. Download your free copy of Googling God today by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources.
Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
Well, hello and welcome to another episode of Matters of Life and Death. As always, I'm Tim Wyatt and I'm joined by my dad and Dr. John Wyatt.
What was all that about then? Yes, it is Professor John Wyatt to you.
Well, I'm emphasising the doctor because it's going to be relevant, because we're talking about an issue of medical ethics, and I've got no qualifications here, but I wanted to emphasise to the listeners who might be new that you actually do know a little bit about what you're talking about in this topic.
It's a deal.
Before we launch into it, we should say, just a kind of health warning for those listening, we are going to be talking a little bit about infertility and reproductive technology, in particular sperm donation. We're very aware, of course, that this is a really sensitive topic for lots of people who might be listening, who might either have loved ones or themselves be kind of struggling, unable to have children, or wrestling with their different options. So it may not be right for everyone. Please feel free to move on if it's not on the right for you. But just, we wanted to be up clear that no one is kind of blindsided by that. So the story kicks off with a Netflix documentary called The Man with 1,000 Kids. Have you come across this, Dad?
I hadn't. It was you who pointed me to this rather clickbaity title, isn't it?
It is a bit clickbaity, but it's a really fascinating, some would say horrifying story. It's basically about a Dutch man called Jonathan Jacob Meyer. I might have bungled the pronunciation there. Apologies to the people in the Netherlands. Who has been found, who's believed to have fathered as many as 1,100 children all over the world, because he is a compulsive sperm donor. And the story is basically, in a nutshell, that this bloke cannot stop himself from continuously donating sperm. And after he was caught having done it as many as, you know, hundreds of times in the Netherlands, breaking the rules there, he was ordered by a court to stop. And he just basically went kind of onto the dark web and found kind of private Facebook groups and did it kind of unofficially. And some of his victims, the parents who were not told that the donor sperm they were using has already fathered hundreds of children around the world, believe that he's just kind of carried on overseas.
So to backtrack a bit, sperm donation is registered and controlled in most Western countries. There are formal sperm donor banks and registries. And normally there are strict controls on how many donations any individual donor can provide, and for obvious reasons. And each donor is screened, and some basic information is obtained, and then the sperm is stored and frozen, and then made available to those who are to a woman who is seeking a sperm donor. So presumably what he had been doing is contacting many different donation agencies around the world, giving false names, and providing samples.
He did. So the Dutch rules say you can only you can't father more than 25 children in 12 separate families. But he basically got around that because it wasn't very well regulated. And even when he was the kind of Dutch official, kind of reproductive industry wised up to what he was doing, he basically just went online and started advertising his services as a prospective sperm donor, kind of without the middleman at all. And this is apparently not that uncommon. Sometimes parents want to do it because it's kind of cheaper and quicker, or you can have more control over what, you know, the origin of the sperm in theory. So apparently, yes, there are lots of people around the world who got in touch with him, and he kind of insisted, oh no, I've only done this once or twice before, and they liked him, and he kind of pulled the wool over their eyes. And it was only after they'd already conceived and had the child that some of them figured out that actually this child has up over 1,000 half siblings.
Yes, and so again, particularly in the USA, both sperm and egg donation is highly commercialized. Surprise, surprise, and you pay according to the quality of the donor. So there's a kind of market, you know. And if you want a high IQ, sporty, musical, tall, athletic, then the market is, you know, is you pay a lot more to have sperm from a donor like that. But I think in Europe it's more, you can ask for criteria. You can ask for obvious things like ethnic origin, and so on. But apart from that, normally in the European agencies, there's no kind of commercial market depending on the donor characteristics.
And we should say, just on the UK context, the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Authority, the HFEA, which regulates this, put out a statement actually after the Netflix documentary came out and said, you know, we appreciate this series might be stressful and upsetting for the families of some donor-conceived children. There are strict rules. There's a 10-family limit guidance, which restricts the number of families that can be created with a single donor in any UK licensed clinic. And clinics must also ensure that any donor sperm or eggs imported into the UK adheres to this limit, because that's the other key factor, is that this Dutch guy, he apparently donated to a Dutch clinic, which then posted sperm around the world. And so it was obviously, once it's overseas, you know, there's very little ability of the Dutch authorities to control it. And reading between the lines, the HFEA here in the UK can ask clinics to check, but there's no real way. Unless we had some kind of, you know, 8 billion strong international DNA database, there's no real way to know that if the sperm in this test tube that has been sent from somewhere else in the world to a UK clinic, whether that person has already conceived 10 families. It's unenforceable.
Yes, but the other important element in all this is that previously the donors was kept strictly confidential, so that the recipient and the child who was conceived might never know who the donor was. But the UK changed the rules and basically said that once the child becomes 18, they have the right to approach the HFEA, and the HFEA will give them information about the sperm donor. Yeah. And surprise, surprise, this led to a sudden decline in the number of sperm donors within the UK, because, you know, the idea that you give a sperm donation as a student and then 20 years later there's a knock on the door and there's a person standing on the door saying, "Daddy!" So I think what then happened is that many people who are trying to find sperm in the UK feel that they're forced to go to international groups, including the Dutch, the Scandinavians, because they have looser rules. They don't insist on breaking confidentiality.
Yeah. What do we? Why does this happen? I mean, he's not the first person. I mean, I think you told me about there was an earlier case when the technology was a bit newer, when it was found that one of the doctors running one of these clinics was a kind of prolific donor without really telling anyone and had fathered many, many children. There are other cases in other countries. What is in it for someone to father thousands of children through sperm donation.
I mean, it's an extraordinary phenomenon, isn't it? And yet it kind of intuitively, it feels like the head mammal, you know, the primate pecking order, when you are the top primate,
the most virile rises to the top.
You have the right to father a large number of children, and it's a proof of your power and your prowess, and all the lesser males. I mean, it's a very basic kind of biological instinct, isn't it? And it clearly taps into some kind of power, power fetish.
I think there's something else about... it's a kind of vanity project, isn't it? Because you're saying, my genetic information is, you know, I'm creating this kind of empire. Even if a lot of these people don't know me as their father, I know that I'm creating kind of empire of mini-me's around the world. You know, it's like, you know, sometimes, you know, ancient emperors and kings would have harems of concubines.
Yes.
And so they would have, you know, maybe one or two legitimate children, but they would also have hundreds of illegitimate children. And that was a kind of power play and a vanity thing, and something about, and also just because, you know, they liked having lots of sex without any consequences. But I wonder if there's elements of that for these people where it's like, I am now the kind of patriarch of this clan, unbeknownst to them or without any of their consent, who are now part of this kind of strange family.
Yes, but I suppose the problem with that is I just hope nobody finds out. In other words, it's a rather strange vanity project, which... Yes. I desperately hope that nobody else discovers.
Yeah.
You know, I know that, but I hope they never find out.
Yeah.
But interestingly, as we've said, there have been a number of cases like this in the past, and they have come out because often by some kind of chance event, it suddenly turns out that people who are related in ways that they didn't anticipate. How did this come to light in this particular case? How was it worked out that he had fathered so many children?
It's not actually particularly clear from the reporting I've read. There is some indication that potentially some of the mothers started to connect online, but I'm not entirely sure how they knew that they were all... I mean, I think some of them said, you know, some of them had met this guy, Jonathan Meyer, in person. And he had said, oh, yes, I'm just doing this out of altruism. I've only done it once or twice before. And then they're like, well, I've already met 37 people who also met you and heard the same thing. But I don't know exactly how they're able to piece together the kind of thousand number. I think it's unclear. But in other instances, there's been similar cases where there's also been kind of prolific sperm donors. That came about because of this new technology where you can buy a DNA test online. People often do it as a kind of Christmas present for their relatives, and you spit into a tube, you send it off, and then they tell you some information they've derived from your genome, you know, where your ancestors, you've got 25% Barbadian ancestry or whatever it is, but they also obviously plug you into these for-profit kind of private consumer databases of which are ever growing of DNA. And so there was one case a few years ago where an English person did that same thing, got a kind of spit in a tube, send it back, and discovered that they had hundreds of half siblings on this website's database who they were genetically related to, who they'd never heard of, and that's how they discovered that he was the donor had been a little more prolific than his mum had realised.
So one of the fascinating realities is that the use of donor sperm and donor eggs is not unusual. There are probably thousands of cases a year in the UK. But previous studies have suggested that the large majority of parents never tell the children, although best practice, they're always told that they should wait for a suitable opportunity and explain to their children what their genetic origin is. And in this case, that the person that they have been calling daddy and they think of as their daddy, actually is not their genetic father. And their genetic father was somebody in Holland who has also fathered other children. And it's interesting as to why so few parents actually tell children. Mm. And therefore, of course, the implication is there are many people walking around who simply do not know that they were conceived by donor gametes.
Maybe even listening to this podcast right now.
Which is an extraordinary thought, isn't it? And some parents would even go to their grave and never tell children. But I've also heard of a kind of deathbed confession. You know, I'm dying, but there's something I need to tell you before I die.
So what do we think is behind the psychology of the parents not wanting to tell that? Is that simply shame? Is it a sense of embarrassment? They wish it hadn't happened. It's an awkward hurdle they had to use to start a family, and it's all in the past now. I don't want to go back there.
I think there is a kind of shame. I mean, at one extreme, it could even be seen as a kind of adultery. You know, that it's almost as though this child has been conceived out of wedlock, and just in the same way as a child who's conceived as an affair, that you want to try and keep it quiet and you don't want anyone to know. Maybe there's some kind of association there. But I think one of the very important points that comes out from all this, and that is that when parents have infertility and they're using reproductive technology in order to have a child, it seems that their entire focus is simply on having a baby, getting pregnant. That's all I'm thinking about. And however I do it, my goal is to get pregnant. And I don't really think through what the implications will be for a child who's conceived in this way. And then I only, you know, and now this all happened 10, 15, 20 years ago, and now I am coming home with the implications of what this means and what I've got to say. And I never really thought about this, and I thought it wasn't relevant. And now suddenly this is a big deal.
I guess I found this conversation more and more interesting over the last few years because I've been reading and learning a lot about the psychological consequences for children who grow up separated from their genetic parents, primarily because, as I've mentioned before, our daughter is adopted. And so, you know, in our training, the adoption agency told us a lot about how challenging it can be for a lot of children to grow up separated from their birth parents. This is a kind of primal wound in some sense that maybe never fully heals. And obviously in adoption, it's kind of unavoidable because children have to be removed for kind of their own safety. But knowing what we know about how psychologically and emotionally destructive and harmful this can be, and the questions that children are left with, and the sense of loss of not having that relationship, it's slightly staggering to me that we are so casual about deliberately creating children with this wound. You know, it's one thing to say a small number of children will have to be separated for their own safety, but there's nothing to say we are going to actively generate more children with this potential struggle, identity challenge in the future.
Yeah, and I think what's fascinating are the studies of adults who were conceived as donor by donor gametes. There have been a number of studies asking adults about their attitudes, what attitudes. And there was one particular book which I was very struck by. It's called Who Am I? We'll put the details in the show notes, but there were several quotations from that book that I thought were really telling, and I think you also were quite struck by them, weren't you, Tim?
Yeah, definitely. It's really interesting hearing the voice of people who can kind of reflect back on their experience. One of the quotes that jumped out to me was this one. The contradictions inherent in an industry that seeks to provide maximum genetic continuity for its customers, yet routinely treats the genetic kinship of the offspring and donors as expendable, are blinding. And I find that very striking, as I never really heard it phrased so compellingly, which is that the whole reason why kind of donor sperm exists as an industry, it is for parents who are unable to conceive by themselves, but wish very strongly that at least half of them, at least the mother, will be genetically related to the child, and so will use another man's sperm allied with the mother's eggs. And so that it all exists because we believe genetic continuity, that a genetic bond is important, is relevant, is meaningful, is precious, something to be sought after and worked for, sometimes at great cost. And yet in the process, we're completely blasé about the genetic continuity between the child and the donor father. That is immaterial, that is secondary, that is irrelevant. It is a jarring contrast.
Yeah, there's another person who said, many people love to talk about their ancestry, yet society is encouraged to turn a blind eye to the inherent discrimination involved in kinship construction and destruction via use of donor gametes. It's a type of empathetic blindness encouraged and appealed for by the infertile, the fertility industry and its advocates. It is fueled not just by the personal convictions of those in the industry, but by that industry's undeniable profits. The donor offspring are made to order, to fit a design. They are the next best thing to having one's own genetic child, and they are presented and objectified as something to which someone else has a right.
Hmm. And this, I think, strikes at those identity questions in a different perspective, which is, it's not just knowing that you have another father, a second father somewhere else out in the world, but it is knowing that you were built, you were made, you were ordered. You are, in some sense, a commodity. And I know that's quite a harsh reading of it, and that's not how many parents who have gone through this process would understand what they're doing at all. And I don't want to minimize for a second the genuine, serious, deep pain and trauma of experiencing infertility and not being able to conceive naturally, and the yearning and longing that people, understandable people, have for children at all. But I think it's important to attend to the voices of children who have been conceived like this, and to think carefully. Are we sending an unintentional message to our children in the means by which we created them?
And I think the honest truth is that, despite this evidence, the vast majority of parents who are going down the infertility route, it never crossed their mind what the child might think. You know, the whole focus is on creating a baby, and I think because of the profit motive, it's not surprising that the fertility clinics don't say, now, hang on a minute before we do this, have you really thought through what the child is going to think about all this? Instead, everything is focused on, we could do this and we could do that and we could try this. And it's all about improving it's a phrase which I always revolt against. They called it the take-home baby rate. You know, how can we maximize our take-home baby rate? And it is that kind of commodification.
Yeah, it's a service. You're selling a service.
Yeah.
Baby-making service, yeah. Mm.
Before we get back to this episode, I just want to take a moment to remind you that this podcast is only possible thanks to the support of listeners like you, which makes your gift today so important. That's why, to thank you for your generous gift today, I'd like you to have a copy of a new ebook from N.T. Wright called What Do We Mean by Heaven? The Resurrection of Jesus and the Rapture. This new ebook offers profound biblical answers to questions about salvation, the resurrection, the afterlife, and the rapture. As you uncover the important answers, you'll also be encouraged and challenged to find peace and hope in the deep mysteries of life. Again, it's our thanks to you for your gift to help more people live as confident, informed Christians. To give your gift and download your copy of N.T. Wright's ebook, What Do We Mean by Heaven, the Resurrection of Jesus and the Rapture, simply go to premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. That's premierinsight.org/matters of life and death. Thank you for your support.
You're listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.
And this, while you can understand exactly how we ended up here and the kind of good intentions behind a lot of it, and let's not be clear, you know, the vast majority of people who donate sperm are not Jonathan Meyer and are not compulsive, strange oddballs trying to have as many kids as possible and deceptive. the vast majority of people, I think, are people who genuinely think and want to help people who are infertile and think, look, this is a gift. You know, I think some people would say it's very similar to doing organ donation, you know, giving a kidney or something like that.
Yeah, and that's one of the fascinating things, though, isn't it? Because superficially, donating sperm or eggs seems to be similar to donating a kidney. In fact, it's considerably less risky than donating a kidney. But there is a very profound sort of human and even theological difference, because the sperm and the eggs are the means by which parenthood is conferred, biological parenthood. You know, they have almost a sacramental significance. They are in themselves just little cellular pieces of tissue, and yet the significance of them, you know, I'm thinking of that curious phrase from the scriptures where it says, you know, that the descendant was in the loins of Abraham, the genetic. And of course, this is hugely important in the scriptures, isn't it? Because of the lineage for the Messiah.
Yeah.
You know, the lineage is of immense theological significance. And so treating sperm or egg donation as simply donating tissue is to completely misunderstand its significance from a human point of view. But it's also the biologically, we're in a very strange situation now because there are so many people conceived by donor gametes that it's perfectly possible that two people can meet and be attracted to one another,
yeah,
and not recognize that they are. The reason they're attracted is because they actually have, they're half siblings. There is some kind of genetic connection.
Mm.
And there's biological evidence showing that people can feel sexually attracted to a stranger who, unknown to them, is genetically related.
Yeah. So, yeah, the kind of objective, factual kind of, you know, putting aside the psychological harms, the fact is that this Dutch donor, Jonathan Meyer, has, by his deception, very significantly raised the risk of kind of accidental incest, because there are now thousands of people running around the world who have no idea that they have thousands of half-siblings. And as you say, there is this recognized strange phenomenon of people being attracted to a sibling who they weren't raised with. I mean, it's also been observed even in full siblings who were separated for various reasons. This is often in times gone by, separated at birth and raised independently, and didn't know they had a sibling, an older or younger sibling, or even a twin. And then they bump into each other in later life and often feel a very compelling attraction or desire. So it's kind of biologically super harmful as well as psychologically really destructive.
And the UK has come up with a characteristically bureaucratic solution to this problem, which is that the HFEA keeps a register, and recommended good practice is that whenever you are thinking of choosing a mate with whom you're going to create a child, good practice means that you should check with the HFEA database to see whether you are genetically related. And I'm sure you did this, Tim, before you chose to marry
of course,
your prospective wife, yes, that you checked with the HFEA. Could I just check whether there's any link?
Yeah, you change your name on the driving license, you get your bands read, and you send off the consent form to the HFEA to check the register. It's all part of the standard procedure at most wedding planners.
And yeah, interestingly, if there is what the message will come back from the HFEA, not to say, yes, you are genetically related and your father is X, but simply, there is a problem and we do not recommend that you proceed.
Yeah. And given, as we mentioned earlier, estimates are that up to 85% of children conceived by donor sperm have no idea, you know, why would you think to ask? I never thought to ask. I've never questioned whether I was conceived by donor sperm. And so you've never delved into that. And I think that'll be true of most people who actually are, where it is relevant to them.
So again, it just shows unforeseen consequences, don't you? You invent a new way of creating human beings, but the ramifications, biological, medical, psychological, even spiritual, are unforeseen.
Okay, here's a question then. If we're aware, and as I said, the evidence primarily from kind of social services and from the adoption industry is increasingly strong, that it is quite psychologically harmful to know that you are separated from your birth parents or parent, is it not the most loving thing, therefore, if you are parents who have conceived a child via donor sperm, is it not more loving to hide this from them? Is it not more loving to lie? Because that child will never question the fact that they don't look a bit like their dad. They would never question that. They will just live their life in blissful ignorance. And okay, there's a small risk. There's a tiny risk that they might meet one of their half siblings. But in reality, that is not less than 0.001% chance in a world of millions of people. So is it not more loving just to hide that fact and protect them from it?
Well, it's a possible argument, but I think it doesn't work on a number of levels. I mean, it doesn't work just because maintaining a lie, you know, and maintaining that lie and never letting it slip out, whatever happens, is exceedingly difficult. The truth is always easier to maintain than to maintain a lie. But secondly, it's interesting that a lot of donor children, and it comes out in this book, a lot of donor children, when they do discover the truth, it's suddenly, well, I always thought it was weird that I was looked completely different from my dad, and that my personality was totally different, and that he seemed like a stranger to me. I always thought that was weird, and now suddenly I understand why. Or else there was always something about my mum who she kept, it appeared as though she was wanting to share something with me, but then she couldn't find herself to do it. And then eventually on her deathbed, you know, after 30 years together, she said, there's just one thing I need to know. And then suddenly my whole, you know, history falls about my ears. So I think, just as with adoptive children, all the evidence shows that the best way to deal with it is very early, that the child never starts to discover this truth right from the beginning. You can see why that doesn't happen, you know. So right from the age of two, we should have been telling you, Tim, that you weren't, that I'm not your real daddy.
This is not the best place, not on a podcast. It's not the right way to confirm that information. But I get that. And I think, you know, in with adoption, it used to be the same. You know, historically, lots of parents were either encouraged or, you know, nobody minded if they kept it a secret. And there was the idea that, I mean, let's be honest, this was mostly, but I think, because of a misguided sense of shame or embarrassment. But there's probably also the idea that, you know, it's better if the kid didn't know. And we've now realized painfully over many decades that actually it's always better for the child to know, notwithstanding the fact that it will still be challenging and difficult. And there's also, I think, the sense in which, even if there is a possible universe in which you maintain the lie at no cost to yourself and your own integrity, and your child never suspected, it is also fundamentally dishonest. And I think there's an argument to say that children have a right to know the truth about where they come from. They have a right to know, even if it might cause them some psychological harm, they have a right to live in the truth rather than live out their whole life in a lie. It is disrespectful to your children to treat them as children into adulthood and never reveal the truth about where they come from.
No, I totally agree with that. And I have a kind of strong Christian intuition about that too. And yet I do know a whole number of Christian parents who haven't told their children.
Really?
Wow. So... But I agree with you that you know, this seems, this hiding this kind of fundamental information from your child is not consistent with genuine respect, you know. And I think that is such an important Christian insight, you know, that God doesn't hide stuff from us.
Even when it's hard.
Even when it's harsh, you know, actually he confronts us with the truth, but he does it out of love. It's not It's a false love, a patronizing love that seeks to conceal the truth.
Hmm. And in some way, it comes, I think, for some parents out of a desire for control. You know, there's unforeseen consequences. If I let this secret out, who knows how my child will react? Maybe they'll reject me. Maybe they'll go out searching to find their second father or their second mother. And there's a sense of I think some parents might feel the fragility of their parenthood is their parenthood is undermined by revealing this fact. And suddenly it's like you've put a bomb underneath your family life, and who knows how it might blow up.
So from a Christian point of view, it is interesting that although the Roman Catholic Church has always maintained a very strong argument against all forms of reproductive technology, so both IVF as well as gamete donation, the Protestant and the Evangelical churches have actually always in general been quite positive towards reproductive technology. They've seen this as a Christian option for infertile couples, and they have as also the Jewish faith has tended, even Orthodox,
really?
Jewish people tend, provided they follow rabbinic law, and which has been created for reproductive technology, they're actually quite positive towards lots of the form of this technology. And it seems as though the positive side of creating a new life is seen as overwhelming the negatives of, okay, it's a bit unfortunate about the genetic problems and so on.
Hmm.
And it's interesting just to reflect on why that is. And it sounds like we both of us are expressing concerns about what many other Christians would be in favor of.
Yeah, I think it's certainly worth reflecting on that. I mean, I'll be honest, I think when I first thought about this, it was probably in an RE or ethics class at secondary school. I thought, you know, donor sperm or eggs of all the kind of reproductive technologies out there seems to be of the order of the kind of least ethically questionable, the least problematic. I would probably have, at the time, lumped it in with something like surrogacy. And would be more, I was more, had more thoughts about things like IVF. But I think over the last few years, as I've reflected on this and thought about it a bit more deeply and understood a bit more, and as we've done a series of episodes, you know, we've covered surrogacy and IVF on the podcast before, I am, I think, shifting my opinion slightly. And I think I'm, you could say, you know, closer to a more traditional Catholic approach, which says, I don't think it is as easy as just to say, you know, well, you know, what's the harm? Everyone's consenting adults. It's allowing infertile couples to have genetically related children. Like, you know, where is the harm? I think I'm seeing it more through the children's perspective. And also, I think, as we discussed in an episode on surrogacy, through the kind of the third parent perspective, you know, in the surrogate, in case the mother who carries a child, in this instance, the father who donates the sperm, I think I am more cautious about the idea that you can override the kind of the integrity and the respect and the dignity of these people are in some sense secondary to the mother and the father who are experiencing infertility. I guess we should also say the Catholic prohibition or the Catholic opposition to this is, as far as I'm aware, is grounded in their theology of natural law. And so they have quite separate, quite a different theology to kind of Protestantism, which says, you know, the way the world is as we find it has been set up by God for a reason, you know, and this is also their opposition to things like birth control. And it is therefore immoral to seek to interfere with that, whether that is to stop having children, to artificially constrain the sexual act from being procreative, or whether it is to artificially create life outside of the procreative act between a wife and a husband. And I'm not sure I necessarily agree with that theology, but maybe I'm getting to the similar end point through different means.
Yeah, and to put it in sort of theological language, what is often discussed is about that that marriage has two aspects. It has a procreative aspect and it has a unitive aspect. And the traditional Catholic view is that in every act of sex, the procreative and the unitive must both be there. That is comes from natural law, that the purpose of sex is to procreate, and therefore you mustn't impede the procreative. And that's why they're opposed to contraception as well. Whereas what Protestants tended to say was it was important that in a marriage the procreative and the unitive were together, but that didn't mean that any one individual act of intercourse was open to procreation. And therefore, that's why most Protestant churches accepted contraception, provided it was done in a responsible and thoughtful and quotes, godly way. I think that's the roots of it. But it is interesting that you could certainly argue that donor gametes really rides a coach and horses through the procreative and the unitive, because you're bringing in this third party who is involved in the procreative, but who has no connection in the unitive. And it's, I mean, I've tried to popularize that by saying making love and making babies belongs together. And that what we're doing here is we're separating the making of babies from the making love, and that has unforeseen consequences.
I guess I have a particular interest in this question of ethics because, you know, me and Jess have chosen not to have biological children and to adopt instead, not because we've experienced infertility, but because we think that's what God is calling us to do. And I think there are some Christians out there, maybe not to my face, but who would have questions about whether that is ethical and appropriate, because we are saying for the course of our married lives, we are going to, you know, opt out of the procreative, use technology to opt out of the procreative element of our marriage as a conscious ethical choice, which is obviously slightly different to, you know, adoption is obviously different to conceiving through donor sperm. But yeah, I've always had questions about, do we go too hard on the idea that kind of every marriage should be focused on this procreative aspect? Are there different ways to procreate that aren't purely through conceiving children in sex?
Yeah, that's really interesting. And you're not alone, are you? There seems to be a trend of a number of younger Christian couples who are making a similar decision. And you know, which I think it's a wonderful choice. It's what I think, again, theologically, philosophically, what I would want to is draw a distinction between procreation, normal procreation, which is really to do with creation. It's the way that God made us. It's the way that God made the world, that making love and making babies belongs together. That's not an accident. That's part of creation. But choosing to love and adopt a child who needs parents, whose biological parents are not capable of looking after her, that is an act of grace. That is, we're not now talking about procreation. We're not talking about creation, the way the natural order. We're talking about grace. And one of the fascinating things is that it's often said by theologians that grace recapitulates and fulfills creation. That they're not unrelated. God's grace in the gospel is the final fulfillment of what he intended in creation. And maybe so the act of adoption in a way is a fulfillment of God's creation plan for procreation.
And you see a similar theme when you look at, for example, you know, the people of God, and the promise to Abraham is through your loins, effectively, there will be a great people. And obviously, as we know, you know, the Jewish people make great store of the fact that they're all Abraham's children. And there's that kind of blood or even seminal tie, you could say. And yet when Jesus comes, there is a recapitulation and grace enters into the stage. And under the new covenant, after his death and resurrection, God's family, God's people, God's nation are grown not by genetic descent, but by grace. They're grafted, you know, the Gentiles can be grafted in. And anyone, you don't have to be circumcised. You don't have to be a child of Abraham or daughter of Abraham to become part of God's family. You are welcomed in through grace. And some people, some Christians draw parallels with adoption in that sense, in that it's you're expanding the family, the micro family through grace, which is a picture of how God's family is expanding through grace, not blood ties, it all the way up to the new creation.
Yeah, profound stuff.
A final question then. If a Christian couple were considering starting a family, expanding their family using sperm or egg donation, would you caution them against it? Would you say, you know, look at, it's obviously an extreme case, the man with 1,000 kids, most sperm donors are not like that. But do you think this case kind of highlights some of the underlying problems with how that form of reproductive technology operates?
Yeah, I think the first thing I would say is I think the couples need to have this conversation before they get married. You know, we used to do marriage preparation in our church courses for couples, and we used to emphasize that you need to talk about these things. You need to talk about what happens if we were to discover that we were infertile. And because you sometimes find different people come to very, very different conclusions, and it can be a source of a lot of conflict within relationships. So I think the most important thing is that couples really think deeply and talk about this together and seek to inform themselves, you know, before making decisions. Again, I know of Christians who've rushed into reproductive technology and only then later on, you know, have rued the day in terms of why didn't we think more carefully about it? You know, we created all these frozen embryos and now we don't know what to do, and perhaps we should have thought about it before, and so on. So I think reflecting beforehand is very important. Yeah, I think the honest answer is I wouldn't say no, that would be quite wrong for you to use donor sperm or donor eggs. But I would raise questions. I would say, have you thought about how you would feel if, and how the child might feel, and you know, would you like to read this book of donors conceived children? And you know, I think it's important that people go into this with their eyes open and think through what the implications will be for the future. And the fertility clinics are not going to tell them that. So then I feel a responsibility, and I think the churches need to be laying a foundation of understanding about what it means to procreate and about the kind of things we've been talking about making love and making babies and why they should belong together and what the arguments are.
And I guess fundamentally, if you cannot conceive of yourself sitting down and telling your child that they have another father or mother out there, if that conversation seems impossible to you, then that's a clear sign that you shouldn't be doing this. Because as I think we're both clear that children, it is dishonest and disrespectful to hide that knowledge from children. Children have a right to know where they come from. And if you feel that you'd be unable to reveal that truth, then I think that's an indication that this is not the right thing for you to do.
Yeah. And isn't it interesting? Because I think that's a wider ethical question and test, which applies to a lot of medical ethical questions. And that is, if I cannot imagine having to go public about the decision that we've just taken in private on some deep medical ethical dilemma, I think that's a red flag. I mean, why is it that I feel, yes, this would be fine for me as long as nobody ever knows? As long as nobody will ever discover, that's fine. I think that in itself is a kind of red flag. And that if this is something that, where it's appropriate, we can share with others and say, yes, it was a very hard decision, but this is what we decided. If you feel you can't do that, then that suggests to me there's something deeply troubling about this.
Yeah. And there's an interesting parallel there in the adoption conversation, again, where historically it was something that people didn't talk about. Even if they did tell their children, it was very private, secret, potentially embarrassing, shameful. Whereas I've always been very clear when I talk to people, you know, it's not necessarily the first thing I tell people about our daughter, but I have no embarrassment whatsoever. I'm proud of the fact that we adopted her. And that is because it's not a secret, shameful thing. It's a positive choice. I believe it was a moral, ethical thing to do, a positive thing to do. And I think if you're not, as you say, if you're not able to embrace your choice and be proud of it, including telling other people that, yeah, that definitely is a red flag that maybe you need to think again. I don't want to stand in judgment, of course. You know, we're aware that people listening to this might be having these conversations themselves. And as we've said, we never on this podcast want to say X is sinful or whatever like that. It's not really what we're about. So I hope we've been trying to share some of our own thinking on this and how we read the Bible and understand ethics from a Christian perspective. But we'd love to hear your thoughts, particularly if you disagree. We'd love to hear some different perspectives. If you're going through this yourself, if you've were conceived through reproductive technology, we'd love to hear from you and hear your own thoughts about identity and these kind of questions. So do get in touch. You can email us molad@premier.org.uk. There's lots more material and resources on, particularly on this question of medical ethics, on Dad's website. That's johnwyatt.com. And the book which gave this podcast its name, Matters of Life and Death, it was a book first, has several chapters on reproductive technology, infertility, and those things from a Christian doctor's perspective. So I'd encourage you to go and find a copy of that. There are links on Dad's website too. But otherwise, we'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, bye-bye.
You've been listening to Matters of Life and Death, a podcast from Premier Unbelievable.